Showroom in Bloomington. Orleans Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
This is Jeffrey Dvorkin, Ombudsman at NPR. Concerns or criticisms about what you hear or don't hear on the radio? Let me know. I'll make sure they get to the right people and you get an answer. Here's how to reach me. Write 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20001. Phone 202-513-3246. Email ombudsman@npr.org. Thanks for keeping the public in National Public Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about Iraq. And our guest is Aaron Glantz. He's a journalist. He's a reporter for Pacifica Radio and for other media outlets. He has visited Iraq three times during the period that the U.S. has been occupying the country. He was there for a month right after the fall of Saddam Hussein. He was there February to May of 2004, and he was also there during the elections in January of 2005. His work from Iraq has also been syndicated to newspapers around the world by Interpress News Service. We'll be talking this morning about some of what you will find in a book that he's authored. It's titled How America Lost Iraq, and it's published by Tarcher Penguin, in which he explains that somewhat to his surprise, when he got there right after Saddam Hussein fell, he found that a great many Iraqis were very supportive of the American invasion. However, that didn't last very long, and we'll talk about what it is that he found here in this first hour of the show. We'll be very happy to take questions and comments from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving. But, of course, anybody is interested in calling in, being a part of the conversation, you can do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just a little bit more about our guest, Aaron Glantz. He's a founding producer of Pacifica Radio's national newscast, Free Speech Radio News. He has reported from a number of places around the world, including Egypt, Turkey, Jordan, South Korea, Indonesia, India, Vietnam, France, and Denmark. Before becoming an international reporter, he served as the California State Capitol reporter for Pacifica's flagship station, KPFA, in Berkeley, where he won the California Journalism Award for Radio in the year 2000. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. Also, I do want to mention that he'll be giving a talk this evening at Pages for All Ages Bookstore. That's at 7 o'clock. So anybody who is here in and around Champaign-Urbana that's interested should feel free to stop by. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I guess in the interest of a full disclosure, I want to ask about what your thoughts were, feelings were. Did you have a position on this war before you went to Iraq or even before the war started?
Well, I work for Pacifica, and Pacifica is an anti-war radio network. And I went there as a journalist to tell stories that would show the human side of the war. So I didn't go to Iraq when Saddam Hussein was the president because I had no illusions about what kind of dictator he was. I knew that in the election that he organized, 100% of the population turned out to vote, and 100%, every single person, not even 98% or 97%, 100%, got to give it to Saddam, voted for him. But at the same time, I was very uneasy about the war. And when I was in Turkey during the lead up to the war, I visited this village called Özverin, which was 200 miles from the Iraqi border and 800 miles from Baghdad. And it had been bombed by an errant U.S. Tomahawk cruise missile. And it was one of three Turkish villages that were bombed by the United States by mistake. And we also bombed Syria and Iran by mistake during the war. And I just figured that if we were bombing the wrong countries, that the situation on the ground in Iraq would have to be pretty terrible and that the people in Iraq could not be very happy about that.
So you went. And when you got there, it seems as if one of the first impressions you had was, essentially right at the beginning, you were surprised because you expected it to be in much, much worse shape, there to be much more damage as a result of the war than there was.
Well, that's right. I got in a taxi, an orange and white checker taxi in Amman, Jordan, and just took a taxi into Baghdad about 2 weeks after the fall of Saddam Hussein. And I did this. It was possible to do it at that time. The road was reasonably safe. And pulled into Baghdad, and even though the whole country was just in a crazy state, I mean, there were two-day-long lines for gasoline at the pump in the most oil-rich country in the world. This annoyed people. There was no electricity and no clean water because of the war. This annoyed people. The telephone grid had been bombed as a regime target because Saddam Hussein used the telephone system, and, of course, regular Iraqi people also used the telephone system. But having said that, houses were not bombed. Schools were not bombed. I went to a hospital that was bombed, but it had been bombed because there was a Fedayeen fighter in the hospital firing at an American tank. And it was the fighter and not the American soldier who gave up the hospital's protected status under the Geneva Convention. And even when I traveled to some places where innocent civilians had been killed in bombing campaigns, like in Al-Mufraqiya, which is outside of Kut in southern Iraq, the people that I interviewed, they had had other family members who were killed by Saddam's regime. And I interviewed this man. His wife had been killed as she was hiding in her home. And she said, her husband said, listen, I just got out of Abu Ghraib prison where I was electrocuted and held upside down simply for marrying my wife in a traditional Shiite wedding ceremony. I was electrocuted in prison. And if this is the thing that's going to end 35 years of suffering under the Ba'athist dictatorship, if this is going to end our suffering, then we're prepared to make this the last suffering, this invasion.
So overall, the people that you talked to said they supported the invasion. They thought it was good. The goal of getting rid of Saddam Hussein was good. So how did people react to all of the various discomforts, and that's maybe to put it mildly, that came from the American bombing that did all this damage to the infrastructure? So there wasn't reliable clean water. There wasn't electricity. They couldn't use the telephone. That, I'm sure, must have made life very, very difficult for people.
It was. People had this memory, though, that after the 1991 Gulf War, when America invaded and bombed Iraq, and that bombing campaign was actually more severe, after that bombing campaign, Saddam Hussein rebuilt the electric grid in 3 months. So people had some experience of things being broken and then fixed in Iraq. And I think a lot of people genuinely thought that, okay, this is an inconvenience that's come out of a war. But now Saddam Hussein is gone, and now we can begin to put our lives back together. I think what they didn't count on was that the U.S. military would stay in Iraq and not allow them to rebuild their country on their own. And a lot of the people I interviewed, the same people who were so happy that Saddam Hussein was gone, I mean, it was a lot of this thank you very much, now go home kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. Who did Saddam Hussein oppress? He suppressed a Shiite Islamists. And I went to the Free Prisoners Committee, which was set up by the U.S., to help people who had been imprisoned under Saddam find out where their family was and have family members find out if their relatives were dead or alive. And I met a man from Hizb al-Dawah, the Dawah Party, which is Ibrahim al-Jafari's party, the new prime minister. And I said, why are you here? He said, well, two of my brothers were killed by Saddam Hussein for rising up against his regime in the early 80s, trying to install an Islamic State in Iraq. And I said, so what do you think about the current situation? And he said, well, we thank God that Saddam Hussein is gone, but I don't think it will be good if the Americans tried to stay, because no dignified person can allow a foreign power to stay and rule over them. And we really hope that the Americans leave now. And there were massive demonstrations at that time for elections in Iraq. But even though there were these mass demonstrations for elections, and even though because Saddam Hussein was a brutal dictator and kept good books as a result, it would be very easy to organize elections very shortly after his fall. Instead, we hired a company out of North Carolina called RTI, Research Triangle Institute, and their slogan was selections, not elections. And they were charged by the U.S. government with handpicking the local councils in each city. And this ran exactly counter to all the talk about freedom and democracy. And as this happened, as the lack of basic services continued, people started to get more and more annoyed at the U.S. military.
Well, it seemed that one of the stated goals of the United States in rebuilding the country and in seeing the government reconstituted would be to have a government that excluded people that had been involved in the Ba'ath Party and had been part of the previous regime. The idea seemed to be that it should be a complete house cleaning, and that the people who would be coming in would those that would be not have been tainted by having been associated with the previous regime. Was that a mistake?
Well, I think that dismissing the entire Iraqi army, which is what Paul Bremer did, was absolutely a mistake. I think that he could have skimmed off the leadership faction of the army, Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist cohorts, and tried to encourage some new leadership in the army and allow the vast majority of the army to stay in place. This was a conscripted army. You had to join the army under Saddam. It's not like the entire army of Iraq was Saddam's henchmen. So I think that was a big deal, because now you have George Bush trying to train a new Iraqi army. And he's very unsuccessful at this. And the reason is because nobody in Iraq believes that the new Iraqi army is an Iraqi army. They see it as a proxy army for the occupation, which is now unpopular. And so what do you do if you join the new Iraqi army? You go and kill other Iraqi people. This is not a popular idea. And so when America attacked Fallujah, April 2004, half of the Iraqi army deserted, and another 10% mutinied, which is that they used the arms that we gave them on American soldiers. And this is not because the Iraqi army has been infiltrated by insurgents. It's because people in Iraq don't want to kill their neighbors for America.
Let me ask you one other question, and then I have a caller here, and I want to promise this person I will not make them wait forever, and certainly other people will be welcome into the conversation. It seems that one of the pictures that we've been presented is that the conventional wisdom was that the United States thought that if you could go in and get rid of Saddam Hussein and get rid of all the people in his ruling circle, that then the majority of the people of Iraq would say hooray, they would cheer, they would get up, they would dust themselves off, and then they would say, let's now get on with rebuilding this country. And that instead what happened was there was chaos, there was looting, there was crime in the streets, it was a huge mess. And I'm sure that there are some people who would say that, yes, America made countless mistakes after Saddam Hussein, after the military goal had been achieved, but that the people of Iraq somehow failed to step up to the plate and do what they could have done and perhaps should have done to try to normalize society again and to try to get some kind of normal life going.
We did not allow them to do that. I did a story while I was there about Iraqi companies, how Iraqi companies who wanted to take part of the rebuilding process were excluded from bidding on projects in their own community. So I interviewed this man, and Bechtel Corporation from San Francisco, my city, they have the contract for rebuilding the schools, the electric grid, and the water system. And the Los Angeles Times reports that of the 24 water treatment plants that Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco claims that they fixed, zero are currently working. So I'm interviewing these contractors, and they're saying, listen, we don't even know how to bid for these projects. That it's all being done in some other room, and we don't know where it is, and we keep calling Bechtel, and they never call us back. And this is a guy in a nice suit with a nice office, and he has a lot of experience with projects all over the Middle East. You will find so many engineers in Iraq driving taxi cabs because of the economic sanctions on the country for years. I mean, Iraq has an old Soviet-style electric grid. Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco, they're great engineers, but they don't know a lot about old Soviet-style electric grids. But you know who knows a lot about that is Iraqi engineers who helped build the system, and they were excluded from rebuilding it.
We have a couple of calls here. We will start to talk with people and take as many calls as we can. Continue also to talk with our guest here, Aaron Glantz. He's a reporter for Pacifica Radio and other media outlets. He has been in Iraq a number of times since the U.S. occupation began. He is the author of the book, How America Lost Iraq. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. He is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We'll give a talk at Pages for All Ages Bookstore tonight at 7. So if you're interested in meeting him and stopping by, you can do that. And of course, here on the program, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of people here ready to go, both of them local. We'll start with line number one. Hello.
What are some details of traveling like? How long did it cab take and what currencies do they accept? And does a person get a visa somewhere in Europe if they have consulates there or just at the border? Because the do you have to sign a disclaimer? And who's in charge of the customs? Things like that. The news had an interesting story on a train trip, and it said there were no lights on the train, but there's still plenty of food available.
No, the logistics of traveling in Iraq, the currency is the Iraqi dinar. It's not the old Iraqi dinar with Saddam's face. There's a new Iraqi dinar. It's about 1,500 Iraqi dinar to the dollar, and a lot of the more expensive things, kitchen appliances and such, are priced in dollars but bought and sold in dinar based on the daily exchange rate. If you want to go to Iraq, and it depends how you want to get there or what the process that you should go through. If you want to fly into Baghdad, you can do that. You can fly to Amman, Jordan, and there are daily charter flights to Baghdad, the old Saddam Hussein International Airport, which is now called Camp Victory by the Americans. I don't recommend that because the airport road is under constant attack by insurgents, because they know that every single person getting off that plane is a foreigner, and that's why the airport road is among the more dangerous roads in Iraq. So you should get a visa from the Iraqi embassy if you go that way. But the way that I would go in and out of Iraq is I would fly to Diyarbakir in southeastern Turkey, and I would catch a cab and go to the Turkish, Kurdish Iraqi border in the north. And there, they have their own government, so they don't really care what the Iraqi embassy says. They look at your passport. They decide kind of on the spot whether or not they want to take you. And then I would transfer to another cab and go to Erbil, which is the capital of northern Iraq. And I think there's a big lesson, actually, if you look at the relative peace and calm of northern Iraq, into what the United States did wrong. In northern Iraq, there is stability. There are not regular attacks on American troops. And I believe this is because the streets of northern Iraq are not patrolled by American troops. They are patrolled by Kurdish militiamen who fought Saddam Hussein for years, who are well known in the community. And they can tell the difference between a criminal and a neighbor. And so you have a Kurdistan Ministry of Health, a Kurdistan Ministry of Education, a Kurdish parliament, and they have autonomy. They have freedom. They're happy. You go to Baghdad, the Americans are patrolling the streets. You have constant American patrols through neighborhoods. They knock down doors. They take people off to Abu Ghraib prison, where there are about 10,000 people being held without charge, without trial, a year after the public Abu Ghraib prison scandal. And there you have the difference in interpretation of the U.S. military between Baghdad and northern Iraq.
All right, let's talk with someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Yes, I wonder if those photographs that are still being held up, I believe the judge has ordered them to be released, but the Pentagon won't do it. Photographs from Abu Ghraib, I don't know if they're ever going to be released or not, or if so, what date is it going to be?
I don't know the answer to that question. The caller is talking about a second batch of prisoner abuse photos from Abu Ghraib. This is actually from the same camera that took those first photos that everyone is probably familiar with. And the Pentagon is saying that it will just incite violence in Iraq to release them, and so they're trying to suppress them. The important thing to me is the Iraqi people know what is going on in their country. I was in Iraq when the Abu Ghraib prison scandal broke in this country, and
yes,
people were not surprised because they knew relatives who this had happened to. And I went to this village called Abu Sifa, which is about an hour's drive north of Baghdad in the heart of the Sunni Triangle. I write about it in the book. In this village, the Americans came in the middle of the night looking for one prominent Ba'athist who they said was attacking a local base. They went to the biggest house in town. They ordered everyone out of the house. They machine gunned the house. Then they fired two shots from the barrel of their tank, destroying the house. But it was the wrong house. And because they didn't know who they were looking for, they rounded up 83 men in this small village that only had about 100 men, a farming village. And when I visited the village in March of 2004, a month before the Abu Ghraib scandal broke, 82 the 83 people arrested 9 months before were still in prison. None of them had been charged with any crime. None of them had been allowed to see a lawyer or their family. And the only one who had been released was a 15-year-old boy who told me that dogs had been put in his cell. every night. Every night, a different dog by a different American soldier. And the really terrible thing about this story is that you would hear these kinds of stories all the time. And so the Pentagon is concealing these photos to keep the American people from seeing them because the Iraqi people already know what's going on in their own town.
Yes, they say that they'll instigate riots and violence against Americans. It seems to me that violence against Americans is already occurring there.
Well, I think that it's being instigated by the activities that the American soldiers are engaging in rather than the photographs of those activities. And if the Pentagon wanted to get people to be less upset, the thing to do would not be to suppress the photos. It would be to stop taking people off to Abu Ghraib in the first place. I mean, what's the green zone? The green zone is Saddam Hussein's presidential palace. It was off limits under Saddam's regime, and now it's off limits under the American regime. What's Abu Ghraib prison, the most notorious lockup under Saddam's regime? Now it's the most notorious lockup under the American regime. These 14 permanent military bases that the U.S. Senate has voted 100-0 to build, these are Saddam Hussein's old military bases, and we're just upgrading them to make them more comfortable for us. So what message does this send? Meet the new boss, the same as the old boss.
Yes, the best thing we can say about our occupation is that we're no worse than Saddam. However, the pictures seem to have a great effect on the American public.
Well, that's right. That's what people – I had been filing stories, actually, for a long time from Iraq about the kind of story that I was just telling you. Or I filed another story from Sadr City about an American patrol that came through and they arrested a man in one building, and the errant American soldier's bullets accidentally flew into another building and killed this guy's wife, and he was trying to get compensation for this. And other kind of stories about, like, abuse by the U.S. soldiers of Iraqi people. I don't think they were making any traction with folks here, but when those photos came out on 60 Minutes 2, they made a huge impact here in America. But in Iraq, more important and happening at the same time was the attack on the movement of Muqtada Sadr and the bombing campaign of Fallujah, where so many people were killed by the U.S. military that the municipal football stadium had to be turned into a graveyard. And you want to talk about pictures. There were no pictures of that in this country. But Al Jazeera, the Arab satellite network that most Iraqis were watching, they were broadcasting wall to wall from the hospital of Fallujah and from the football stadium. And they were showing the fact that most of the people killed in the American bombardment were women, children, and the elderly. This is totally unlike the initial bombing campaign, which was very strategic. This was a campaign to wipe out the city after the killing of those four American contractors, where their bodies were hung on the old Fallujah Bridge over the Euphrates River. So these actions are what got a lot of play in Iraq. And they radicalized people in Iraq. And the Abu Ghraib prison, people were just kind of sad to see those photos because it confirmed what they already knew.
But the pictures that I've seen on the internet of American soldiers raping Iraqi women, now you have to be really careful about them because they're mixed in with a whole bunch of porno photographs. But the one, you have to be really careful, but the ones who look genuine to me, I show them to people and they're just absolutely, they're mind-boggling. People say, these are our soldiers?
I don't know that there's a lot of rape of Iraqi women going on, and I don't know if those photos are legitimate. I don't know anything about that.
I should think that, well, I mean, I looked at the ones that I thought that I had no reason to believe that they looked genuine from, you know, the surroundings and the blurred out pictures, you know, blurred out parts. And I think that they were, the purpose was to rape them to get their families, their male members of their families, to confess as to what they knew, theoretically, what they knew about the insurgency, I presume. I'm only flying blind here.
Well, that was absolutely a strategy of Saddam Hussein's regime, and I interviewed a number of people who told me that they had been imprisoned under Saddam and that they had been forced to watch relatives of other prisoners small children and wives of some of the other prisoners get raped in front of their eyes. But I don't know of any cases under American occupation where that particular form of torture has happened.
Yeah. I need to jump in here because we're already at our midpoint and we have some other callers here. What the caller says is extremely troubling. And also we know that obviously photographs can be fake, they can be doctored, and there have been some photographs like that already that have come out of Iraq of questionable provenance. Now, I just want to make sure that you're saying that as far as you're concerned, you have not heard anything about such a thing happening.
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of terrible things happening. People ask me, have you heard anything about napalm being used by the U.S. military in Iraq? I say, look, I haven't heard anything about that. It's probably not true, but at a certain point, it doesn't matter what kind of bomb you're using to kill people. The point is that you're destroying their house and they're dying. And you can say the same thing about the caller's complaints, her allegations. I mean, I don't know anything about them. They're probably not true. But imagine yourself in Iraq. Those kind of allegations, unproven allegations, are swirling all over the place all the time. And that has an impact on the way people see American troops, whether or not the allegations are actually true.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me again very quickly introduce our guest. We're talking with Aaron Glantz. He's a reporter for Pacifica Radio and other media outlets. He's been in Iraq three times during the U.S. occupation for a month, right after the fall of Saddam Hussein, from February to May 2004, and also during the elections in January 2005. He's reported for Pacifica. Also, his work from Iraq has been syndicated to newspapers around the world by the Interpress News Service. He is the author of the book, How America Lost Iraq, published by Tarcher Penguin, and is going to give a talk tonight at Pages for All Ages Bookstore, 7 o'clock. So you can stop by there if you would like to hear more. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Go to someone here on a cell phone, line 1. Hello.
Yes, we had a guest several years ago from China for a month, and I think I began to get the picture from him or the feeling from him that they were comfortable, as a whole, with the lack of freedom, as we see freedom, in their country. They felt comfortable with things being set up for them, decisions being made. And I think one of the problems the United States is having here is that we're trying to install democracy, and the Iraqi people and Arabs in general have a different view of self-determination than we do. And I've even heard it said by other experts on the Middle East that the last thing we want in the Middle East is democracy, because the day after democracy comes to Saudi Arabia, that Osama bin Laden would be elected president, and 3 days later he would shut the oil off, and that would be that. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
All right.
I think that's a very important comment. I don't agree with everything that the caller said, but let's look at it this way. There were massive demonstrations, as I said, for elections in the early days after the fall of Saddam, and they were ignored by the Bush administration, which instead hired a company from North Carolina to pick the government. And after 2 years, elections were finally held. And the people elected Shiite Islamists and Kurdish nationalists. They were elected. The Shiite Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari, his campaign pledge was vote for me and I'll get the Americans out in 9 months to a year. And now you have him trying to install Islamic law for family law and all of these things. I mean, I think that the reason the Bush administration has not been pursuing democracy is because the idea that Bush had for Iraq as some kind of laissez-faire, capitalist, modern, democratic European state is not what the Iraqi people who had been fighting against Saddam Hussein for years had in mind. And so first they tried to put Tralabi in, then they tried to put in Ayad Alawi, this former CIA agent in Baathist, who is secular, and they both were very unpopular. And so now the Iraqi people have held their own election. They've elected Islamists to the government, and the Bush administration is playing a game with them, a game of give and take. And it's very interesting for me to watch this unfold.
Yeah. Just to go back for a second, because back at the beginning of the program, you talked about the fact that when you got there, when you first got to Iraq, that people generally seemed to be supportive of the invasion, certainly were happy that Saddam Hussein was no longer in power, and that even though conditions were difficult, believed that the United States would rebuild what had been destroyed. And if there was not electricity today, they would say, well, you know, maybe in a few months, things will get better. And that it wasn't very long before that attitude changed. What was there, do you think, any single thing, and I kind of think I know the answer to this question, any single thing or any single event that was a real turning point for public opinion, as far as you're concerned, public opinion on the American invasion?
Well, the first thing that happened was there were about 6 months, the first 6 months after the invasion, where there were very few attacks on American troops. Mm-hmm. And then during that period of 6 months, people started to get annoyed that there was not a single working traffic light in their city and that it was 125 degrees and that they couldn't sleep because they didn't have a fan and they got grouchy. After this went on for a while, then you had people being taken off to prison at Abu Ghraib for long periods of time and not being charged with anything. And there was a sentiment building in the population that maybe this war and occupation was not such a good thing. Then in April 2004, at the same time the Abu Ghraib photos came out, you had the attack on the movement of Muqtada Sadr by the U.S. military and the attack on Fallujah. And I think that after those two things happened, then everything was lost. And then people were like, okay, I give up. Let's join the resistance and shoot at the Americans. And the attack on Muqtada Sadr is very interesting to me just right now because it's in this attack that actually Cindy Sheehan, the woman who's been camped outside George Bush's ranch in Texas, it's in this particular attack that her son was killed. And it's very instructive. I mean, she's saying my son died for a lie. She's speaking about weapons of mass destruction. The thing about it that's interesting to me is her son died in a completely needless military operation that served to alienate people against the Americans and caused a lot more American soldiers to die later on. Muqtada Sadr is a fundamentalist. But he's an important political figure in Iraq, and his father was killed for fighting against Saddam Hussein. He was a grand ayatollah, and his uncle, Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr, is one of the most important Shiite theologians of the 20th century, and he was also killed by Saddam Hussein. Muqtada Sadr was organizing traffic patrol, garbage duty, other things to, you know, fill in the gaps because the occupation authority wasn't doing these things, and he had a newspaper. Well, the newspaper ran a story that said Bremer follows in the footsteps of Saddam Hussein. And so Bremer closed the newspaper. Then he arrested Sutter's advisors. Then he attacked the movement of Muqtada Sadr with the U.S. military. And I was in Sadr City at the time, and I interviewed a 15-year-old boy who had been shot by an American soldier in the vestibule of his apartment building. And I said, "What do you think about this?" And he said, "I have nothing to say to the Americans. It's only up to God what happens to them." This, and then at the same time, the attack on Fallujah, which I already mentioned, and I talked about how in Fallujah, I went there after the assault. I mean, I interviewed a 12-year-old boy. His 11-year-old best friend was gunned down in front of his school. I interviewed a man who went out to get food aid at a neighborhood mosque during a ceasefire, and he was shot just below the neck by an American soldier. And he told me, "I never thought about joining the resistance before, but now I will fight until the last breath that I have to get the Americans out of my country." And there was almost a click at that point. And it was actually at that point, After that, I couldn't take working in Iraq anymore. It was too difficult for me. I'm not a war reporter type. I started reporting in San Francisco on things like affordable housing and public transportation and things like that. And I just had to go, and I got back to this country, and I saw how little people here understood about what happened in Fallujah and Tu al-Sadr, and that's why I decided to write the book.
Let's talk with some other folks. Next is a caller in nearby community Belgium near Danville, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is right. We're definitely not there for the right reasons. And obviously our president and his organization have their agenda that they're going to fulfill and kill as many people as they can in the process. But to at least take your scenario a step farther here, what do you think would happen if we did decide tomorrow to walk away? Who would take over? Would the insurgents be taken care of by their own people and saying, we don't want you to continue killing us? Or what do you think would happen? Yeah.
I think there are two groups of insurgents. There are what I call the normal people wing of the insurgency and the terrorist fringe of the insurgency. So the normal people wing of the insurgency, I was talking to this auto mechanic in Adamiya, which is a Sunni stronghold of Baghdad. He's in the resistance. I said, okay, Mr. Auto Mechanic, you're in the resistance. What does this mean? And he said, oh, me and my friends, we get together every night at a neighborhood cafe. We drink tea, we smoke cigarettes, and when the Americans come through, we hit them. And if no Americans come through, we bomb the police station because they're collaborators. You take the occupation out of this. This guy's just an auto mechanic. And this is the reason that the insurgency is so successful, because people like him are involved in it. Now, in those first 6 months of the occupation, this terrorist fringe was there then, too. But they weren't nearly as successful because they weren't working together with regular, frustrated Iraqi people. And I think that what will happen is, you'll see, is when we withdraw, all of these people like this auto mechanic will go back to their regular jobs. And then this terrorist groups, the Iraqi people will have to take care of them. But it will be much easier for them to do that without the nuisance of 135,000 American soldiers. And, someone from Illinois, an American soldier from Illinois, it's very difficult for them to tell the difference in accent between Iraqi Arabic and Jordanian or Syrian Arabic. But this is not difficult for an Iraqi. They can tell the difference, and they can tell where the foreign fighters are and who they are. I had a friend, a Korean journalist. We were investigating together this particular case of brutality at Abu Ghraib, and we were invited by the senior sheikh whose sons were in Abu Ghraib to go visit him in Samarra. I said no. I said, Samarra's in the heart of the Sunni triangle. It's crawling with terrorists. I don't want to die. I'm not going. She went. Second day she was there, she was kidnapped by Ansar al-Sunna. She was driven out to a desert camp, and she was held. She might have ended up on television being beheaded if it was up to the Americans, but she had connections with the local sheikh, and so the sheikh sent 70 cars of people from his tribe and demanded that she be released. And within 24 hours of her being captured, she was released. This is a regular story in Iraq. Iraqi society has a fabric, and we are disrupting it by our presence and making it easier for the terrorists to operate.
So what you essentially said then is that if we walk away, there is an organization that will take care of themselves and sort out all the problems they have there, and things might go along just the way they should.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think that's a little bit too good. I mean, I'm not saying that the situation will be good if we leave. I just want to stress that. I think the situation will be bad if we leave, because it's a mess. But I think at that point, the situation could possibly begin to get better. Whereas if we stay, the situation will absolutely continue to deteriorate.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. Just to try to be clear in my mind, at least, when you ask the question, what is it that drives those people that are part of what has been labeled the insurgency, we'll put that in quotes, to what extent is that anti-Americanism and the desire to get the American troops to leave? And to what extent does that have to do with internal power struggles within Iraq and the desire of some people, Sunnis particularly, to make sure that they have a say in how the country is run?
Well, I think it's overwhelmingly to get rid of the American occupation. The reason that the Sunni community of Iraq is more involved in the violent insurgency is because they don't really have the numbers. So they have no ability to change the situation through democratic elections. The Shia also want the Americans out. But they, because they have the numbers and because their religious leadership, Ayatollah Sistani and others, has been calling on people to vote, people have been voting on the idea that if they vote and they gain sovereignty in that way, that the government will cause the Americans to leave. So it's just the difference in tactics between the two groups.
To another caller, this is Gibson City, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a couple questions and then some comments. I was wondering, do you think our soldiers were ill-prepared to go over there? And then second, have you heard of Christian Peacemaker teams, which I am a part of? I've never been to Iraq, but we have had a team there permanently pretty much since just before the war began. And one of the things they ended up doing was doing interviews with people from, you know, all over Iraq and documenting these abuses, not only in Abu Ghraib prison, but in other prisons, and that it wasn't just a incident, you know, or two, but that it was widespread. And they did give this information to the people in the green zone, I guess you call it. And so I guess I just wonder how much the American people understand this, that it's not, you know, not just a few incidences that have happened, but it's widespread. And I also just want to say I appreciate what you do, and I just wonder if you're able to have, like, speak to groups here in our area. I would love to come and have you speak. Unfortunately, I can't come to see it. Pages is of all ages, but I just want to thank you, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
I would really urge people to turn out. I would just urge people to check out the Christian Peacemaker teams. There are a number of groups, like kind of lefty peace groups, active in Iraq. But the Christian Peacemaker teams are very unique in that after the war happened, they didn't just pull up and go home. Instead, they decided to document what was happening with Iraqi prisoners. And they're really the only group that has been making an effort to document that. And they have a website with some reports, Christian Peacemaker teams, and I urge people to check that out. I'm sorry, I forget the...
Well, what the question was, and I don't know how much opportunity you had to talk with American troops there, but I'm interested. One of the questions the caller asked was, do you think that the American soldiers who were sent there were prepared for what it is that they would encounter?
On the first day that I arrived in Baghdad, I came in this old beat-up taxi. I arrived near the Palestine Hotel, and there was an American checkpoint, and the guy at the checkpoint... this very young guy, and he had this helmet, and it came down over his eyes. You know, he could, I just wondered if he could even see with such a helmet that didn't fit him so well. And, you know, he said, turn the car around. This is a checkpoint. And I'm a journalist, and I was allowed to go through, but I was in this old taxi cab, you know, and so he didn't notice. So I got out of the taxi cab, and he said, turn the car around. And I was trying to talk to him, but all he was doing was looking at the fact that I have dark features and I have a mustache. And I was really worried that this man was about to shoot me. And he did not speak a word of Arabic. I mean, I don't expect American soldiers to be fluent, but if they're manning a checkpoint, they should know how to say turn the car around in Arabic and stop and go and things like this. And the only reason that I wasn't shot was actually because I was with this French journalist, and he was blonde. And so the American soldier looked past me. He saw the blonde French journalist, and he said, now that's the man I want to speak to. So were American soldiers prepared? I don't think they were prepared at all.
I think we have another caller here on line number one. Let's go there. Hello?
Yeah, I just have a quick question. I was curious about your general description of the situation. How many other journalists, let's say foreign journalists, do you think would subscribe to your view, and how many of them have been able to get their story through their whatever media they use? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, I think that anyone who worked unembedded in Iraq over a long period of time like me has a pretty similar story to mine. Other people who are with the troops, they have a completely different story because their story is about the American troops, and I respect them because there are 135,000 American soldiers and we deserve to know what's going on with them. But what's really sad is that now the situation has deteriorated. Look, I'm here in Urbana, Illinois on WILL talking about a book I wrote instead of over there reporting. And most of my friends who were foreign journalists in Iraq are no longer there. And I actually trained two reporters to report for Pacifica on an ongoing basis after I left. One of them got disenchanted with reporting because he didn't think it would make any difference, and so he went to work for the Red Cross. And another one, his car got shot up. And so he said, you know what, I'm just going to leave. And he went to Jordan. And so it's a very difficult situation now for journalists.
We have about 7 or 8 minutes left on the program. Maybe I should introduce again our guest, Aaron Glantz. He's a reporter for Pacifica Radio. Spent some time in Iraq after the U.S. occupation and after the after the occupation began and after the fall of Saddam Hussein. He was here visiting Champaign-Urbana. His home is in San Francisco. He is the author of the book, How America Lost Iraq. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. He's going to give a talk tonight at Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy, 7 o'clock. So if you're interested, you can stop by. And questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It seems that now one of the big points of discussion or argument or debate or whatever in Iraq has to do with what kind of form the future of the country is going to take, and the dispute between those people who have this idea that Iraq can be one country, or whether it's going to end up being a kind of a federation of states. And in fact, as you said earlier, almost in de facto sense, there already is a Kurdish state in the north. So there's some question about what kind of country it can be. And I wonder, do you have some sort of feeling about whether it really can be one country or whether it's going to have to be a kind of federation?
Well, you mentioned the federation is a fact on the ground. The issue now is Kirkuk. Kirkuk is an ethnically mixed city in northern Iraq, and there's a lot of oil there. And this is a city that Saddam Hussein purged of the Kurdish population in the 70s and 80s. And now the Kurds want it back. And they want it back so that it can give an economic engine to the northern Iraq region, Kurdistan, which now is without any economic engine. I mean, there's a lot of propaganda out there about Kurdistan being a great booming part of Iraq with a free market economy. That's all not true. I mean, there's electricity for 3 hours a day in Erbil, the capital of northern Iraq. But like I said, people are not shooting at the Americans because the Americans aren't there and because they see that as their problem and they're angry at their own Kurdish government for not fixing it. Kirkuk is potentially explosive. I was in Kirkuk in February of this year interviewing members of the city council. Three of the members of the city council that I interviewed are dead. I interviewed this Arab sheikh. He was one of the few people trying to negotiate a peace between the Kurdish faction and the Arab faction in Kirkuk. And he was in his garden on a Friday morning, and it was like a mafia-style hit. People came by, and they machine-gunned him. So it's going to be that is a very explosive issue. The Kurds want the Arabs to leave, and they want Kirkuk to be part of the federal northern Iraq. The Arabs don't want it. And if a civil war begins in earnest, I would not be surprised if it begins in Kirkuk.
Let's see. We have a caller in Indiana. We'll go there next, line number 4. Hello.
Want to exclaim, as everybody has, it's another excellent program, David, and certainly it's too bad we just can't broadcast it everywhere in the country at the same time. I'm just taken aback by the hubris of this administration. We're falling into the American stereotype, rushing in, boning around, not understanding anything about the culture. And I think the most important thing, in a sense, you said, is that they understand the accents of the different Arab peoples when they speak, and throwing these young kids in there that, probably not even had a foreign language in high school, as far as that goes, have no understanding of these kinds of things. Could you say something in a very general sense, if you want to, about what I'm just going to call the hubris of basically the Republican group altogether? Thanks a lot.
Well, it's not just the Republicans who think this way. It's the Democrats, too. I mean, I've been watching Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry go around talking about what they perceive Bush doing wrong in Iraq. And what they're saying is we don't have enough troops to keep the peace in Iraq. And this is just ridiculous. The problem is the American troops. The American troops go rumbling into their neighborhood with a tank. And then people attack the tank. And then the American soldiers fire back and they destroy the building that the people were shooting at when they shot at the tank. Innocent people are in the building as well as the fighters. Those innocent people have relatives. They join the insurgency, and it becomes a cycle of violence. And so I'm really sad to say that if you turn away from the Bush administration and you get the idea of the Democratic Party leadership, you're also not getting a particularly good idea.
Well, I guess we're still back to the issue of, and unfortunately now we're come down to the point we pretty much have to finish, that of what do we do? There seems to be growing support for the American troops with the United States, for American troops to leave. But and as you said, things won't necessarily be better if the American troops would leave. It seems unlikely that we would, and maybe we shouldn't, just pull out everybody all in the same day. I mean, what do you think would be the scenario that would make the most sense?
Well, if I was George Bush, what I would do is I would go on national television and I would declare victory. I would say, people of Iraq, you have been liberated. Saddam Hussein is gone. There are no weapons of mass destruction, and we have helped you organize elections, and now you have a new elected Iraqi government. We did not come to your country as occupiers. We came as liberators. So immediately, the American patrols through your neighborhoods will cease, and we will withdraw our army to the bases. And over the next period of months, all 135,000 American troops and their coalition allies will leave Iraq. And we are standing ready to support you in any non-military way we can to help rebuild your country at your request.
I think there we're going to have to stop. Much more could be said. We have a couple of callers we can't take. My apologies. But for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Aaron Glantz, he's a reporter for Pacifica Radio. He will be giving a talk tonight at Pages for All Ages Bookstore in Savoy at 7 o'clock. He'll be talking about his book. It's titled How America Lost Iraq. It's published by Tarcher Penguin, so you can hear him. And, of course, anywhere you're listening, you can go down to your local bookstore and you can look for the book and look for it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Support for Focus 580. This program comes from the Infant Parent Institute with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Programming here on WILL also made possible by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields catering department now offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. A bit later today, as part of the afternoon magazine, we'll be talking about helping children with learning disabilities find social success. Celeste Quinn is the host for the show. She'll be talking today in the 1 o'clock hour with Richard Lavoie. He has 30 years of experience in the field of special education. He's the author of a book titled It's So Much Work to Be Your Friend. That'll be in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine. We'll take a break. We'll have more Focus 580 after news and an update on the markets.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, supporting the Farm Progress Show August 30th through September 1st in Decatur, Illinois. ADM, resourceful by nature.
And, of course, don't forget to join us at the Farm Progress Show.